Do you happen to have a sound effect that has like some sort of dog? Because what is it, Lassie? Has Timmy fallen down a well?
That's actually got my like my high-pitched wheeze voice that's coming through in the laugh. It's just like really like it's really high-pitched. Yes, welcome. Okay, let's go with that.
Welcome. Episode number, I should learn what episode this is because I've lost track. Six.
Six.
We've gone for a different approach today.
Oh, have we?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, okay. Normally we talk to patients.
Yes.
That's like our whole thing.
That's true. That's the inpatient podcast.
Correct.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's our vibe.
This week.
Yep.
Not a patient in sight.
That's actually, I mean, that's true.
Well, not a patient with, like, I mean, I guess probably everyone's a patient, but, you know, if you want to
That's also true.
If you want to get nitpicky about it.
And I think that, I mean, we go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we recognize that.
Yeah. Today, we talk about caring for patients.
We do.
Before we get there.
Uh-huh.
On an inpatient scale, why does that sound? It sounds raspy.
Yeah, just for a second there, it did. That's what my lungs sound like all the time. That's just my emphysema laugh from before.
The wheeze.
Yeah, the wheeze.
How's your week?
Oh yeah, sorry. The inpatient week.
Sorry, I don't know if you know this. You might not know. I tell you now.
Yeah.
We're recording a podcast.
All right. So, and just standard format.
Do your best to stay on target. We'll see how we go.
I'll see how I go. My inpatient week. Look, it's been good. I mean, I've just, I would call myself barely a patient at the moment, really. I mean, notwithstanding, I have drastic burns to a huge portion of my body. I've finished radiotherapy. So that's 26 fractions of radiotherapy.
26?
26.
I thought it was 25.
No, 26. We threw in an extra one for good luck.
And one for good luck.
It wasn't for good luck. The crew at Peter Mac are listening to this going, Nicole, no, it wasn't for good luck. No, that's the design.
That was the regime.
No. Yeah, that was the regime.
Get it together.
We got the physicists involved. But look, I finished the schedule of radiotherapy, which means that at the moment, I mean, I'm actually not a patient. I mean, of course I am, but I'm in this zone between wrapping up radiotherapy and going, okay, well, we're going to have to do a PET scan in a few weeks, but we can't do that yet because a PET scan at the moment, which is, a cancer hunting scan, is just going to show inflammation of my entire body because it's been filled with radiation. So we just have to sit and wait for a while.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay, then, well, the inevitable real talk question here is that historically you haven't really enjoyed the chasm between treatments?
Yes, because I just love being a cancer patient that much. how do I feel? Sorry, I'm leading the question. Over to me.
This is a great discussion. But yes, how do you feel?
I honestly genuinely feel like I need a break.
Yeah.
Like I really do. I just feel I've just been going hard at patient life for a really long time and I feel quite, I'm carrying a lot at the moment. I'm quite fragile. Like I'm quite like I'm physically fragile, of course, but like I'm pretty emotionally, I'm just dropping the E now, emotionally fragile. I can't even say it. So I'm ready for a break. And I'm already kind of 2 days into my non-patient, non-radiotherapy life.
Yeah.
It feels so good. I've got nothing on. I'm what do you do with a day when you don't have to get up and drive 35
minutes? Your whole day's not cut in half.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just weird. What do you do, Sean, when you don't have to get up and drive me there every day? You must be loving it.
All this free time.
Yeah, how's radiotherapy free life for you?
Well, look, I'm playing less chess because that tends to be what I do.
Your ranking's
drop you off at the hospital, go park around the corner and sit and play chess on my phone till you're
around. And that's the carer's life, right? That is what caring life is.
I think it's important to recognise that if you're a carer, you could get really good at chess.
Yes.
Just think about it.
And so far in today's episode, we hadn't actually contemplated that as something to
talk about. Positives.
It's a talking point.
That's all I'm saying.
It's a talking point.
That's all I'm saying.
Over to you.
I'm in...
okay, it's good so far.
I don't have the excuse of like your inevitable go-to chemo-fog thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't even say that.
Yeah.
Chemo-thob.
You don't have that.
No, I'm just a moron, as we've discussed many times. No, on the theme of me, of you, of us asking ourselves questions, how am I? Well, thanks for asking, Sean. glad someone cares.
I did actually ask, but okay.
You said over to you.
Over to you. I'm sorry, Sean. Please, how's your inpatient week?
Good.
Okay.
Let's serious talk. Mm-hmm. Let's be real for a moment. I have been doing this return to work thing,
mm-hmm.
and this week I had my third day in the office. Lots of working from home.
Yep.
Not many days in the office. This was like the first day when I was in when my team was there.
Yep.
So there was a lot more, oh my God, you're back. Have you been? How are you? That sort of stuff.
Sure.
Which I love. Like, this is not a criticism. It's more constantly talking about your mental health with people is hard. Mm. And they're important discussions, and I don't want to not have them.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it is that, you know, it gives other people an opportunity to open up as well when you start sharing openly about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People join in and do the same, and that's good for them and good for you. But it's tiring.
Yeah,
it's hard. So I finished the day. Let's call it emotionally taxed.
Mm-hmm.
And went home and had a good cry and fell asleep.
Yeah.
Such is the nature of being a mental health patient, I guess.
But I think about, like, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about if I had an illness like cancer, and I, you know, had to go out there and just stick more cancer cells into my body just as part of my recovery, you know, to see how that felt. I mean, that's essentially what you're doing, right? By going to a place that is a triggering place for you.
Let's call it agitating the trauma, sure.
Yeah, totally. And that's actually part of your mental health recovery is to kind of dive back into the mental health trauma. And it's a really complex area, really complex. And yeah, it's a lot to take on, this process, but thank you for sharing it.
Happy to.
Mm.
And on the theme of talking about it,
yep.
Let's go talk to someone that isn't a patient.
Let's do that now. All right, Jess Pratt, welcome to the Inpatient Podcast. Tell us how you became a patient.
First of all, thank you for having me. I actually consider myself a bit of a patient by proxy, in that I myself do not have a diagnosis, but my husband Dean was diagnosed with metastatic colorectal cancer at the age of 35, so in May 2019, 6 months after we returned from living overseas in Dubai for 6 years, we got back to Australia, renovating a house, finding jobs, getting back onto Medicare, all of those really fun things. And then, a very big diagnosis came our way. And then pretty much from that day until this day, and, you know, we're approaching 3 years now, I've been Dean's carer and sort of have ridden that roller coaster alongside him, but sometimes my cart veers off onto a different track and does its own little loop the loop, and he does something else, and then we meet back up. And that's sort of my introduction. I'm a carer, and it's a job that I take seriously, but it's also actually now my full-time job.
So we are really grateful to have your perspective, Jess, and have you join us today. I think that the role of carer within a health crisis, within a chronic health situation, within any sort of situation is so it's just an area that's probably not understood. And you know, we can take it from probably our shared experience of you know, advanced colorectal cancer all the way through to what I imagine would be Sean's experience as, you know, someone who works in emergency services who's probably had to kind of think about the role of the carer in the emergency scenario. You know, I don't think we necessarily give it a lot of thought. So we're really grateful to have you join us today. I wonder if you could kind of take us through the experience of being a carer, you know, at that point of diagnosis in what is a very kind of fresh and new situation, all the way through to how that kind of evolves as your knowledge evolves, as your experience evolves in line with your husband Dean's experience.
Yeah, sure. So I sort of sum it up like I went from being, you know, a part-time primary school music teacher who taught some improv at night time and had a show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival because comedy is my thing. And I went from that one Wednesday morning to the afternoon of that Wednesday becoming a carer. You know, instantly sort of Dean got out of a colonoscopy. We were dragged into a room. We were told that there's something, there's a mass. It doesn't look good. You need to go get scans. You know, and he's groggy from anaesthesia. So I am now driving him to a hospital to sort scans. I'm now consoling relatives. I'm making frantic phone calls to a GP to try and get him some sort of sleeping tablets so he could actually, you know, calm down and get some sleep that evening. And then the next sort of 3 days after that, once scans came back and said, okay, it is, you know, cancer in the rectum, but something's lighting up on your liver. By the Friday, you know, we're sitting in a colorectal surgeon's office and then he said it's stage four. And I think my knowledge of cancer can be summed up in the fact that I just said, how many stages are there? And is four a bad one?
Yeah.
And I just had no idea, like nothing, no clue at all on anything. And so then the learning began from, they tell you not to Google anything, but, you know, we're going for PET scans. I don't know what a PET scan is.
Yeah.
I don't even know, again, I don't know the stages. I know nothing about chemotherapy. It took until the second meeting with an oncologist for me to realize that there's different chemotherapies for different cancers.
Yeah.
And Dean probably won't lose his hair. Then there were meetings and we're seeing an oncologist, a colorectal surgeon, a liver surgeon, and I've got a notebook and I'm writing everything down because I know nothing.
Yeah.
And in between all of this, you know, you're expected to continue on with normal life. You know, you're meant to still go to work. You're meant to still function. And that was just, that was crazy to try and think that your whole life as you knew it is no longer ever going to be the same as it is with the patient. But as the person who, you know, everything at the start for them is quite overwhelming and they've got all these feelings going on, you know, they're dealing with this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And as the person who's their closest, you're the one writing everything down and on the phone making appointments and making sure appointments don't clash and how are we going to get you there? And, okay, in my professional life as a teacher, I'm then reworking my teaching timetable and negotiating with the PE teacher if he could do my first two lessons so I can get Dean to an appointment.
Yep.
And then I'll take the afternoon lessons. And like it was a whole, it was a logistical nightmare to try and get through. That was just the first couple of months, you know, a huge learning curve. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you're dealing with insurance companies and filling out long service leave forms that you know you're not eligible for, but you're just hoping that your employer is nice and will give it to you, you know, all these sorts of wonderful, fun things that are actually not wonderful or fun.
At what point can you kind of describe how, I guess, that tempo transitioned for you? You know, did you have to ultimately make the the call, I can't maintain the intensity here and work has to stop? Or were there more sort of medical reasons why you had to think about, you know, how much time you spent at work? Or how did you kind of approach that reality?
Yeah, so look, I was really lucky. I was working part-time already, so I had a little bit of leeway to sort of change things around and move things around. And also the school I worked for is this beautiful, lovely independent school, Cornish College, shout out to them. they're just great, and they did everything that they could. Like, honestly, I'd only really been working there for, you know, 6 months, but they were bending over backwards to help us.
Yeah.
But it got to a point, probably we hit about 12 months in, and I realized that I really couldn't juggle this anymore due to the nature of the work. So I would spend a lot of time, like I said before, rejigging my timetable, trying to be at every appointment with Dean, getting information. But then, as you know, in the public system, things do not run on time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were booked in for 9 a.m. Well, it was 12:30 and we're still sitting in the waiting room. And so I was meant to have already been back at work. So there were a lot of instances like that.
Yeah.
Scans get booked in, specialist appointments get booked, and they're so last minute, or they get changed. And so on top of that, I mean, just being a primary school music teacher, I would see sometimes in a day 100 to 120 kids.
Yeah.
So the logistical nightmare of dealing with germs and children, you know, because I was teaching four-year-olds up to 12-year-olds. So that's a lot of germs. It's a lot of potential gastro. It's a lot of common cold.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is all pre-COVID.
Big COVID germs even became a problem. This is like back when we just thought about gastro as a germ.
Right. And so, you know, I started my paranoia even about just common cold. You know, kids would be walking into the music room and I'd hand sanitize everybody. They'd leave. I'd Glen 20 everything. So, you know, I'm a bit of a mad person by this point. And then COVID happened. And it happened to fall in line with when Dean had done, gosh, I'm going to say 12 to 14 rounds of chemo, and he had had a liver ablation, and now they were starting him on 25 sessions of radiation.
Yep.
And COVID sort of kicked in. We went into that first lockdown, and it was during that I sort of took a breath and thought, if we end up having to go back into classrooms, I'm not going to be able to do that. And I was struggling already. The thought was already there about me having to give it away, because I was not doing well at either job. Caring and my teaching were suffering.
Yep.
You know, I always just had one part of my brain was always on Dean when I was in the classroom. And then when I was with Dean, I had a bit of my brain about my failings in my job.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we just made the call once COVID sort of came along, because I also couldn't really rely on anybody else to step in and help out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, early on with no testing and, testing was there, but, you know, we didn't have vaccines or anything like that. We didn't know how it was really being transmitted and all of that. So I couldn't really call upon anybody else to do that job, and I didn't want anybody else to do that job. I didn't want anyone in the house. I didn't want us around anyone.
Yeah. So once you take caring on as a full-time role, then what was your experience like in terms of the rest of the medical system, the health system, acknowledging you, you know, creating space for you, responding to you appropriately as the carer, rather than, you know, just talking to the patient? How did you navigate that, and how did that go?
I think I found a switch happened with COVID. Pre-COVID, which, you know, we did a year of this journey pre-COVID, you know, the nurses, the staff, the admin, I mean, Dean's a young guy with a very distinctive mustache. If anybody ever finds him on Instagram, it's a fantastic mustache.
It is.
But he's also a very, it's great. He's also a really likable guy. And we make a point of wanting to be kind to the people that we meet in the health profession. You know, they're there to help you. So we always made an effort to be greeting everybody, speaking kindly. And so, you know, I always sat with Dean for his duration of chemo, and sometimes that could be 6-7 hour days. And everyone was always nice. Sometimes they would rather obviously talk to the patient than to you.
Mm-hmm.
But also when sometimes I would explain, look, he's a bit chemo foggy or he's a bit overwhelmed, I need to ask this question on the telephone to you.
Yeah.
Can you please talk to me? It would then be, well, are you his power of attorney? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I am, but I'm also his wife and I am the person that's taking care of him. And I'm telling you right now, in the state that he's in, he can't make this phone call right now.
Yeah.
So you need to let me do that. But then when COVID happened, I saw a huge change. You know, I was no longer allowed in the hospital.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting in the car for that 6 to 7 hours because I told Dean that I would be there every day and every time and for everything. And now I'm nowhere and he's doing this all on his own. And no matter what I said or what I tried to get across, that for mental health reasons, for his own anxiety, for my mental health and my anxiety as his carer, I really need to be with him. It just wasn't happening. There was sometimes really bad news that was given to him alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's just, I know and I get it. We're in a pandemic and there were times where I thought, well, if I'm not in there, then that means nobody's in there.
Yeah.
So he's safe, you know. Yeah. So there was a bit of a conflict there too. I wanted to be there, but I also knew that no one else was in there, so there was an element of safety attached to it. But what I found the most interesting, and this probably happened more at the public hospital level than the private hospital level, was that I'd always try and get in the doors because you never know. The rules were always changing, you know, constantly changing. Mm. So I'd always walk up as far as I could get with him before I could, you know, had to say goodbye. And there'd be people in front of us who, you know, would be able to be allowed in twos. And then we would show up and they'd look at Dean and the first question they would say is, how old are you? And he'd say, oh, you know, 36, 37, and then they'd just say, do you have trouble walking? And he'd say no, and then they'd look at me as if to say, well, what are you doing here? And you know, and these are at the main sort of doors of the hospital. And I would just be very blunt and say, well, he has stage 4 cancer and we're going for a meeting with his oncologist and I don't want him to be alone if today's the day that he's told no more treatment. Oh, yeah, okay. Because there was just this perception that you get in general public anyway that Dean's got a glorious mustache, a full head of hair, and, you know, he looked relatively well. So why would they let him in with me?
Yeah.
When, you know, the lady in front of us who was in her 70s going to get a scan was allowed to have somebody with her. So when you kind of think, okay, and she possibly needs that person to assist her walking, or maybe she doesn't need that person. But just because it was always weird, that question of, well, how old are you?
Yeah,
do you speak English?
Yeah.
And can you walk?
Yeah.
Like they were the three main reasons is to have somebody with you.
Yeah, which points
which
to
I found bizarre.
It's so interesting, right? Because it points to someone somewhere has done some kind of risk assessment that sort of suggests that yes, okay, well, if someone's a falls risk, then we need to make sure that's handled. Or if they've got a communication because they speak, you know, like a communication issue because they speak a language other than English, then that's a communication yeah. issue that's acknowledged and understood. But what about if someone just, you know, needs the support of another human being? What about if someone has a mental health issue? What about if someone suffers from anxiety? What about if someone has, you know, other very well medically understood problems that need to be accommodated within that framework, I guess, is your experience?
Yeah. And you know, we would try and negotiate things. Like I'd say, look, I'm happy to isolate and test and, you know, do all the things that are expected of the patient. Yep. I'm happy to do those as well as his sort of full-time carer, but there were no real provisions for that. And some days it would work and I'd get in. Some days it was not even worth trying because you sort of stopped at the door and sent back out. So,
yeah,
and then, you know, that was, you know, that's 2 years. And even now, you know, getting in to sit with him during chemo, not possible. It wasn't possible the last time he had chemo.
Mm.
Now he's just come out of hospital from having had an ileostomy procedure.
Yeah.
And I was given special consideration to be on the exemption list.
Yeah.
So that I could go in each day and, you know, he's got a stoma and he's got to learn how to change the bag, clean mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. Do all of these sorts of things. And so there's a lot of education that comes along with that.
Yep.
And so thankfully that was through a private hospital. I was allowed to go in and do those things and sit with him and have meetings with the dietitian and the
yep.
stomal nurse, things like that. So that was good. And that was on the proviso that I did a rapid antigen test every day
yep.
and wore an N95 mask. And a couple of times they threw a face shield at me, which I just put on because mm-hmm. I thought, okay, I didn't wear one of these yesterday, but I'm wearing one today. Fine. Whatever you guys need,
yep.
I'll do it.
Different risk framework. Sure. Okay. No worries. Yeah.
Sure. I must say, though, when I dropped him off for admission, he was in all sorts of pain.
Yeah.
I mean, desperately needing this operation.
Yeah.
Could barely stand. And to get inside the hospital on a 35-degree day, we both had to have a rapid antigen test and stand outside
mm-hmm.
while that 15 minutes happened.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't let me go in. And I said, look, he's possibly going to pass out if you don't let me go in and sit with him and just prop him up.
Yeah.
Because I am his power of attorney, so I can sign papers, admission papers, I can pay, I can do all of those sorts of things, but this guy is not going to make it onto the ward
yeah.
unless you let me help him. And as it turned out, they had to get a wheelchair and wheel him onto the ward, and I carried all these bags.
Mm.
But technically I wasn't allowed in, and they weren't keen on me being there, but yeah. they also saw what sort of state he was in. So,
yeah.
You know, at that point I think common sense came into play. I do think that the you know, the chemo nurses and even the oncologist, I do think that they all feel that way, that you should have someone with you. It's yeah. more the people above that make these decisions who yeah. probably aren't on the wards day to day and yeah. don't see what these patients are going through and just how much of a difference it can make for them to have just one person with them.
Yeah, and I think that you articulate that so brilliantly and hopefully, you know, the more of these conversations we have, the better in terms of awareness. But what you also have done is, I think, pivot your experience as a carer into something really quite significant and game-changing on, you know, on behalf of the Australian health system, really, in terms of being quite a vocal advocate in terms of your experience and starting to participate in more and more conversations representing carers and representing your unique point of view. And I just wondered if you could take us through some of that advocacy work and what drives you to be a vocal participant as a carer?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for that. I know it could be just from my background in doing comedy that, you know, I feel like I have a voice. So it would be a shame to not use it. And I wasn't using it anymore in my profession, but my profession changed and I felt that it was important that people understood what we were going through. I was a complete novice. If you had asked me a career path, like to list all the careers in the world, nursing would be the very bottom of the list. It is something that I just know that I would struggle with. And here I was sort of in one sense having to become somewhat of a nurse, you know, for the person that I love more than anything in the world. And I wasn't prepared for it and I didn't understand how much of a job it is. Mm-hmm. And it's huge. You're a dietitian, you're a psychologist, you're a secretary, you're a, gosh, you're everything to this person sometimes. And, you know, if you're doing that standard bowel cancer chemotherapy, you know, for 3 to 5 days out of a fortnight, you are everything to this person.
Yeah.
And so I just started highlighting that. And I also felt that if I knew nothing, there are more and more people out there that know nothing like I did.
Of course.
And so I just started bringing to light what our days looked like, you know, what coming home from chemo meant, which for Dean, which was, you know, lie on the couch, try and sleep. But for me, it was completely change the bedding, disinfect the whole bathroom, you know, get all the vomit bags in the spaces that they need to be in, make sure we're stocked up with Hydralyte. Like for me, it was this ongoing job and all I needed Dean to do was to do the resting bit and I had to do everything else. And so I just started showing that. And then more and more people sort of were like, wow, we had no idea, which was great because I was like, well, now you kind of do.
Yeah.
And then I started getting contacted by more carers who were either sort of in it with me and going, oh, thank goodness you're highlighting this. And especially during COVID when, you know, you had your sort of anti-vax, anti-mask, anti-anti, you know, and I'd got quite vocal about that and said, well, you know what? A lot of cancer surgery is elective surgery. So right now, if hospital numbers go up and we're cancelling elective surgery for a lot of cancer patients, that could mean they don't get their stoma. That could mean that they don't get their liver ablation.
Yep.
That could mean that they don't get a spot in ICU because they're stage 4 and at some point they might pass away anyway. And somebody who was unvaccinated, they get to go on the life support machine. So I just, you know, started to say, and look, that's really harsh, but like brought light to those sort of things. And then I had other carers saying, thank you for talking about this stuff. This is how we feel. And then I had brand new carers contact me going, I feel so overwhelmed. I don't know what to do. Do you have any tips? Do you have any resources? What do you suggest? And I would always just tell them that I started out knowing nothing and with the help of other people and this wonderful Instagram community of following hashtags and stuff like that, you come across more people. And then I just had friends or strangers contact me and say, my best friend has just been diagnosed with insert name here, cancer.
Yep.
What do you suggest I could do to help? And I would just say things like, you know, instead of cooking a meal and dropping it over because you don't know what their system's like, whether they could tolerate the meal that you bought, buy them some Coles vouchers, find out what milk and bread they get and just do it. Just drop it over every Sunday and say, milk and bread is on me for as long as you need milk and bread to be on me. Yeah. Get them a cleaner because keeping the house clean and hygienic is really important during chemo. You know, all these sorts of things. So Yeah, it kind of just evolved from there. And then Bowel Cancer Australia sort of contacted me because I was doing some fundraising for them. And yeah, and then I got invited to be part of a panel on a discussion about young onset bowel cancer. So, you know, it just sort of snowballed a bit. And there's many, many, many wonderful carers out there who do fantastic jobs and great advocacy. And sometimes I feel like maybe they just need a voice as well in all of this. So, yeah, that's sort of how it came about and how it's going.
You were talking before about you reminded me of Nicole's early diagnosis when people were sort of reaching out, not knowing what to do. And there's a lot of, you know, if I can do anything, reach out type stuff that I know I didn't find particularly helpful in trying to help Nicole through stuff. Can you run through some more, like you said, bread and milk before, which is obviously a phenomenal idea. Can you run through some other stuff that's helpful for carers and for patients?
Yeah. So we don't have kids, but I have spoken to some other carers who said that, you know, kids are often very simple eaters. So like a pasta bake or a spag bowl that, you know, if you've got someone who's willing to just make up a large batch of that so small portions can be frozen. So if you get home from the hospital late, you know, you just defrost that, heat that up and the kids can eat that. Because, you know, they're pretty simple, easygoing people. Yeah. Transport's always a good thing to offer because, yeah, in our case, had I had to continue working, trying to get Dean to admit those, he had so many appointments because he had so many different specialists because he had cancer on so many parts of his body. Trying to get to them all was really hard. So offering to drive a person to an appointment, just doing things instead of asking. So if you know that they really love a latte, just go and get the latte and then pop over, knock on the door, hand it over, tell them you love them and then get out of there. you know, just offer to do laundry, like, you know, bring over a big rubbish bag and just go, where's the laundry? Great, I'm loading it up. I will get it back to you tomorrow and just wash it and dry it for them and get it back to them. All those little things where you can just get in and do, go over and weed their garden, whether they're home, not home, whether they asked you to, but no one enjoys weeds in their garden. But when you're sick or you're running to and from appointments, it's the last thing you can think of. But when you drive in your driveway, you see them and it annoys you. Go weed their garden. Like there's just little everyday things. They don't have to be huge gestures. One of the best things a friend of ours did for us is our only form of heating in our house is a Kanara wood fire heater. And we got home from chemo one day and our driveway was just full of red gum. He did a wood order for us and it was just there. And then, you know, it kept me nice and busy for the next couple of days stacking it, which I kind of enjoyed because, you know, I wasn't being as active as I used to be. So I'd just stick my head in and check in on Dean and then I'd stack some wood. And but the thought of having to order wood and then work out when the delivery guy could get there, and you know, it's quite overwhelming when you're in all the other things. So that was a really nice thing. I find people often say, let us know if we can do anything, which is kind because they will if you tell them, but sometimes you're so overwhelmed that you don't know what to ask for. But if they call you and say, what day are you at chemo? Are you okay if I come over? Because I've got a cleaner and the cleaner's just going to clean for you. Or is there a day that you, can we get your lawns mowed for you? And don't worry about it. Lawns are taken care of for a couple of weeks. You know, there's all just so many little things that people can do that really do make a difference.
The other thing I want to ask you about is a bit heavier. I know that there's a pretty massive emotional toll on someone who is a carer and on someone who's, you know, loved one or loved ones are diagnosed with this this sort of stuff. Do you have any advice, or can you talk us through coping mechanisms that you've used, or what you've done to help yourself on that front?
Yeah, so early on, I noticed really quickly that I was getting quite anxious, especially at nighttime, you know, when your thoughts are going. And so, you know, I was reminded of sort of breathing exercises and things like that that, you know, I've done in the past, and I tried to sort of start that up again. I downloaded the Calm app and started doing just setting aside, you know, the 10 or 15 minutes a day and doing some of that mindfulness training. That kind of helped, but at the same time, it wasn't really enough. And it wasn't until after I saw my GP and she took some bloods and she's like, your iron's down, your vitamin D's down, your vitamin C's down, your B12's down. But I was just run down from trying to do a lot of stuff. So, you know, we did some supplements, and I started to, especially when I took the iron tablets, you know, I started to feel a ton better. And then she said, you need to see a psychologist, and you need to just talk to somebody. And here's the person I recommend. You don't have to do it, but I'm telling you, it's going to help. So I made an appointment with her, and her name's Karen, and she's fantastic. And I get to talk to Karen about things that I don't talk to Dean about, that I can't talk to Dean about. I get to talk to her about the things that annoy me about our families. God love them. I get to talk to her about a lot of stuff, and it has really, really helped. And I think that you spend so much time caring and giving and making sure that the person that you're caring for is taken care of, that you neglect your own health and well-being. And I think it's really important that people earlier rather than later put those things into place for themselves. And you think, oh, there's no time, but you kind of have to find the time. And I still struggle with it. You know, there are people that will say, oh, you know, maybe you should go for a big long walk along the beach by yourself. And there's a part of me that's like, well, I don't want to be away from Dean for that long. But I also don't, if Dean doesn't get to do it, why should I get to do it? You know, you get a bit guilty about going out for coffee with a friend or going for a walk, you know, with a girlfriend and debriefing and having a cry. I do think for anyone out there that is a new carer or has been a carer for a while and feels like they are struggling, reaching out for help is really important.
So insightful. Thank you so much for sharing that personal stuff, you know, the personal toll, and that, you know, we opened this conversation talking about how you're a patient by proxy, but of course, taking on such a massive workload, and let's call it a workload because it is, you know, for you, comes with its own emotional complications and its own, you know, physical and mental health complications and everything else. And yeah, I'm super grateful, Jess, and I know Sean is too. And you know, like it's so interesting for me just like sitting here like opposite my brother, watching him ask you questions about being a carer, like just being struck by like, you know what, like maybe I should just shut up really, because here's you know, a guy who's cared for me so much talking to another carer about like, you know, the realities of this and what this is like, and I'm just, you know, I'm super grateful for that, and just for hopefully the insights that it will give other people who have been faced with this and never wanted to be, or are taking this role on for someone they loving and care about, or even, you know, people in a broader scenario and circle who just want to do something to help and don't want to be just asking that question or let me know if I can do something, but just want to do something. And you've just brought that to life with so many ideas. So thank you so much.
I think ultimately, like, no one's life is ever the same after you hear those horrendous words that you've got cancer. No one who is a friend, a family member, a spouse, an acquaintance, a work colleague, like no one in life is ever going to be the same as it was the day before those words were said. So the more that we realize that the people around the patient are also affected in their own way, but all anybody wants is to try and help that patient, that person, that loved one. That's all that we want. And the way that we could do that better and how we can do that better, whether it's through the healthcare system, awareness, raising money, even just simply educating yourself. I am sometimes ashamed of past Jess, of how little I knew about this world. And sure, I would do my fun run and wear my pink ribbon and stick money in if I had change at the fish and chip shop and there was a charity box there, I'd stick it in and I'd do the daffodil day thing and I'd have my morning tea. But I knew nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. And so if it means that there are more people out there that just become more aware, I kind of have this motto, which is, it's quite harsh, but if it's not you, it's going to be somebody you know.
Yeah.
And so the more that you can just understand what it's like to be around that, then you're doing yourself and everybody else a service.
Thank you so much for sharing. Now, I don't want to wrap up this conversation without, of course, acknowledging Dean, because despite his mustache playing a bit of a part in our conversation, I don't know if we've given his musical prowess enough of a shout out. And it's very important to us at the Impatient Podcast because, of course, he has written and performed our own music. So just wanted to shout out to Dean and send him our love. I'm sure you can wrap him in that.
And if anybody wants Dean's on Instagram, you can find him, Dean Pratt, on Instagram. And he, and if you love swing music and jazz music, there's heaps of videos on there of Dean playing his trumpet and being awesome and very cool with that hipster mustache that he's got. So, you can go, if you're just a fan of mustaches, you may not even care
like
about
jazz
anything
at all.
That we said today, but if you're just a mustache fan, I highly recommend you check it out. It twirls upwards, there's oils, there's wax, there's a lot going on.
Oh, he's a champion, and so are you, Jess. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jess. So one of the things I think about a lot in what we'll call my free time is how immense these concepts are that we talk about, that we try to address, probably somewhat stupidly, in an hour and a half podcast episode.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is any exception.
Yeah.
This stuff is complicated.
I feel like a conversation about carers is just so underdone. It's just not appreciated. It's not understood how much an individual's health crisis is actually related to and inextricably woven into so many other lives, And as a patient who's going through something really, really tough, I just couldn't do it without my support network. And I'm the person who has to constantly call on that network. And I do not have the capacity to give mine to, does that person actually have the capacity to help me?
No,
right?
But nor should you.
But I feel like I kind of should. But also, I feel like more broadly, if the system recognized that and was structured in a way that more effectively dealt with the fact that carers need help as well, they need to be recognized in their role. Jess has obviously gone through the process of doing that officially, and she can act, with authority on behalf of her husband, but not everyone in every caring capacity can. Some people are dealing with parents who are older, or they're dealing with a mental health issue, or they're dealing with their children or whatever, and I just feel like if we just stopped and understood that lived experience a little bit more, then that is only going to better everyone.
But it was also self-taught for Jess, right? Like she had to learn that through experiencing what it's like. There's no obvious help. And there's certainly no obvious help from, you know, inside the hospital.
No.
When you're in there.
No. There's no pathway.
You're in the way as far as everybody else is concerned.
Completely, completely. And when you go for help, for questions, for it's like, well, who are you?
Yeah.
You know, I imagine that would be the response. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
But I really, you know, as someone who's in there and is constantly being asked their name and their date of birth to kind of match with the file that's sitting in front, you don't have that name of date of birth, and therefore, who are you?
Mm.
Well, are you my husband? No, you're not. Well, who are you? Why are you here? What's your role? Why, like, why do we care about you? But when you're the person trying to provide that care, you know, you need that recognition and you need someone to make room for you to play your role. And I think that the system needs to think about that. But we wanted to go hunting into that a little bit more.
We did.
And so we found someone who could assist us in unpacking that.
Introducing
Perry Curtis.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if we could kick off with a little introduction from you.
Who am I?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm Perry Curtis. I'm a psychologist and neuroscientist and a brain trainer, which is kind of a mash of all those things, psychology, neuroscience, and clinical hypnotherapy. And I use that model to help people retrain their brain, get out of patterns and into patterns that they would prefer. And I'm also a cancer widow and became an author because of that, because I found that there was no help for care for the carer. So I thought I better write about that so that other people did not have to reinvent the wheel. I'd like to loan my wheel.
One of the things that Jess raised, and one of the things that I've noticed in my own experience as a carer, is the impact that this process has on your own identity, that all of a sudden there's a moment in time where now you're a carer, and what that takes away from your own stuff that you've got going on. Have you experienced this yourself?
100%, and I'm really glad you raised it, because that's not something that people talk about, but it does. It takes a chunk out of you as to who you think you are and who you have prepared yourself to be in the world, and it adds a chunk to you that you didn't necessarily want to have added.
Yeah.
So for me, at that time, I was a high-level corporate. I was a head of, and one of my friends said, you know, maybe you should just hire a full-time nurse carer and keep working. Financially, it would be better for you. And I said, well, what happens if they die? And I've missed it. So I stopped being a leader, and I began making a really awesome cup of tea. And all the other crap that goes along with, oh, you're a carer now. And it does, it screws with your identity, because, you know, I spent 10 years at uni to do what I do, and I felt like all of that was being just not so much wasted, but unused. Mm. And yeah, it does. It really messes with your sense of self and goodness and contribution.
Yeah.
And people who work in the health and allied health and healing areas, our drive is to contribute.
Mm. Yeah.
And then suddenly you're contributing clearly to the one person that you love the most in the world.
Of course.
Yeah. But it's certainly not your skill set.
Yeah.
You're suddenly, you've got a skill set that there's no training for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the point.
Yeah.
You can't go to uni to become a carer.
Yeah. And there's no recognition of it either, right? Like there's no...
Invisible.
Yeah.
I'm sure, Sean, that people have come to you when you have looked like you have gone through a Holocaust and said, how's your sister?
Mm. More times than I care to mention.
Yeah, I talk, I've written a lot about carer invisibility and how it makes you feel unvalued and unimportant and angry.
Mm.
Because really, sometimes we look like we've been pulled through a screen backwards.
Yeah.
And the first question is not about us.
Mm.
So yeah, 100%.
So your point though about the lack of recognition of carers in the system, I want to unpack that, because almost was one step removed, right, as a carer with Nicole.
Mm-hmm.
She's my sister and yeah. I care very deeply for her.
Mm.
I don't live with her.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So her husband obviously went through this to a greater extent than I did, and probably my parents to some extent.
Yeah.
More so than I. But you are thrust into a situation that you didn't anticipate, you didn't prepare for, just in the way, you know, a patient is. But the patient gets the assistance of recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole system is focused on the patient.
Correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it needs to be, but there needs to be something else that gets focused on the carer, because without you, everything turns to, I won't swear, but you know what it turns to.
I'll swear for you. What do we want to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, and like we go from amateur status with an expectation that you will become an expert like that.
Mm.
Mm.
And, you know, I heard you talking about like Googling.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, don't Google.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the first thing you do is go to Dr. Google.
Yeah, of course.
And so you're freaked out.
Yeah.
So not only are you trying to become expert status,
mm.
but all the energy of your brain
yep.
has gone to your fight, flight, and freeze response, which mm. is the reptilian brain way mm. in the back. That's just there for staying away from dinosaurs.
Mm.
Okay, it's a yep. primitive part of the brain. Good luck trying to learn anything with the energy of your brain in either of the stress areas of your brain.
Yeah.
Isn't all going to happen easy.
Yeah.
And people will tell you the same thing over and over again, and you'll look like a bunny in the headlight. And, you know, thank God we have notepads because we could write stuff down.
Mm.
But nobody tells you to write down, take some time for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody tells you to write down, when visitors come over, they know how to use a kettle, go have a nap.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big expectation on carers to just be that, as if nothing else ever happened in your life before.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you become a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, moms. Okay, you're a mom. So that means you are, you know, cook, bottle washer, yeah. psychotherapist, you know, nurse, yeah. surgeon sometimes,
yeah, yeah.
Wine committee, wine committee. Yeah, so there's a lot of expectation on both of those roles. I think there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of moms say the stuff that we're talking about with carers. They go, oh, my God, it sounds like you're talking to me.
Mm. Yeah.
And in a way we are, yeah. because both roles go very unacknowledged and there's a lot of expectation
mm.
without the support for it.
It's interesting that you talk about the inability of a person to sort of learn a thing while their brain's going through that,
yeah.
right? But then, you know, my mind goes to what Jess spoke about, which was her partner going through active treatment, and she calls it chemo fog. Nicole can relate, hardcore,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
where you just sort of dealing with that but adding sort of poison.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then like through a pandemic, say, being told that you have to do that on your own without your support person in the room, like how are you possibly supposed to, like even at a fundamental level, give consent for a medical procedure
yeah.
as an individual patient without a support person
going
through
that? That is exactly right. As a carer, that's how you get a lot of your expertise, because you are in these meetings,
mm.
these consults,
yeah.
and you look at the person you love and you're like, the lights are on and nobody's
yeah.
home.
Yeah.
Talk to me.
Yeah.
Talk to me. Mm. And so, yeah, I don't know how anybody would do it on their own. I mean, for me, being a carer during my own spouse's cancer journey, there was no COVID. I could go everywhere. I was very welcomed. But I don't know how anybody did it through COVID, honestly, yeah. because chemo fog is huge, and even carers are in their own fog because of the stress levels.
Mm.
Mm.
Without any support.
Without any support and without any chemo. Hey, we can be foggy all on our own.
Yeah. without this. Just
wow.
With drugs. One of the things that came up with Jess, I've written in quotes on my notepad. Let me know if there's anything I can do.
I have so much to say about this.
Which is a funny, because it's a question I've asked.
Yeah.
Cool. I've asked people.
We've
this
all
question.
Asked that.
Yeah.
Because at the time when you're told about someone going through something,
mm-hmm.
I don't think your brain necessarily engages to the extent that you would like it to, and you don't know what to say, and it just yeah. sort of comes out. But as a carer personally, It is the most unhelpful question anyone has ever asked me.
Yeah. And, you know, when somebody says to you, well, what can I do? They're saying it from a place of kindness and help, mm-hmm. but they're saying it from a place of not knowing what it's like to be in your shoes. Mm. Other people who I know who have been carers, they don't ask that question. Mm. They go, what's a need I can fill and let's make a time for me to fill it? And then they open their calendar.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of, I married into a very big family. So we had we have 80 extended family members.
Whoa. Whoa.
You should see our pre-Christmas barbecue.
I was just going to say Christmas is fun.
Woo. Yeah, we all went to Christmas. Whoa.
Holy crap.
Do you have to buy presents for everybody?
No. Kris Kringle. No, we don't. But so you got a lot of offers of help. And really, you're on the fly all the time, mm-hmm. when the poop hits the fan, and you know you get the cancer diagnosis, and especially if it's stage four, because it's like, how many stages are there? I know Jess said that.
Yeah,
I'm like,
she did.
But you're so scattered, and then people say, "What can I do? What can I do? What do I do?" And then you go, "Well, you know, I could use somebody mowing the lawn." And then they text you 14 times to arrange a time, and will you be there? And will you leave a key out? And where's your lawnmower? And it's like, Jesus, this is more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah.
So then you do it all yourself.
Yeah.
And one day I was with a friend of mine who's also a psychologist, and she is known to be the organizer. And she said, honey, what can I do? And I said, Jesus. She goes, what's wrong? I said, everybody asks, what can I do? I said, what you can do is organize everybody else who asks, what can I do? She goes, fine.
Yeah.
She said, give me everybody's contact details, names, emails, telephone numbers. And within 3 days, she had set up a closed Facebook page with a roster that people could sign into with every designated area of need that we needed. Mm. Mm. Oh, my God. I love that woman.
I just got goosebumps. That's
phenomenal. I did too. Yeah, yeah. Like my hair is standing up. Yeah. Is your hair? Okay. Where's your hair? I love your gut.
It's rough.
Yeah. So we had a roster, and I actually made a little list here of the, you know, you're not a superhero, so ask for help. Mm. And the areas we got help in was food. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like a roster for food because it means that you don't get 12 casseroles in a week that you don't have freezer space for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was food, it was errands, it was gardening, it was home stuff like cleaning or just organizing or laundry, medication pickup. If you have very specialized drugs, you might have to go and sit at the hospital dispensary for an hour and a half waiting. Yeah. I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
Appointments, taxi service, if you have kids that need to be ferried or maybe taken away for a weekend. And then, also time for you as a carer. Maybe they'd like to, you know, I had a lady who was a friend who was a massage therapist, and she booked into the roster every couple of weeks to give each of us a massage.
That's unreal.
So it's like, thank you. So, yeah, I am big into the, yes, you need help, because you're not a superhero, but that help needs to be systematized so it takes nothing from you.
Yeah.
And if that is one of the things that I could really get across to other carers, get a system, get it early, let somebody else manage it for you.
Yeah.
Because the person who's an organizer, that's a joy for them.
Mm.
It might be hell for everyone else, but for them, they love it.
Yeah. And I guess finding that right person is important.
It is.
If you're... if you're listening to this and thinking, because I'm not that guy.
No, I'm not either, clearly.
I'm not the
organization
guy. But I think that contributing something that delivers time is immensely powerful, right? It's
huge.
Asking the question, what can I do, creates more work.
Yeah.
For
and
the
more
person
stress.
You're asking.
Yeah,
now I've got to think about, what stuff can I get you to do?
Mm. Yeah.
That's not helpful, and the intention is that it is helpful, obviously. Yeah. But offering stuff, time, services is...
It's the practical stuff that you need when you're a carer. It's the practical stuff because about 23 hours of every 24-hour day is the practical stuff. And, you know, then you're going to have people who do things that are lovely for you. Like, you know, if you have a church that you love, people are going to have a prayer circle for you. Great. That doesn't take my time either. Mm. Awesome. Mm. Yeah. But please come and clean my toilet as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Well, we can pray while we're cleaning.
That's I'm a multitasker. I don't know about you.
You said before, and I want to talk about again. Who cares for the carer? Because we, Nicole told, I'm going to get the source of this statistic wrong. Mm. Correct me, please.
Carers Victoria?
Carers Victoria. Mm-hmm. 76% of carers report increased levels of loneliness.
They do. I know.
which I've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And reading about it, I guess, I mean, one, validates it, but two, is sad.
Mm. It is sad. And you do feel very, very lonely. You're cut off from the life you had before, the identity that you had before. You're cut off from all the people that were part of that circle. Mm. So all my colleagues and, you know, and my patients. And often there's a lot of quiet time because, mm-hmm. you know, a patient needs to rest, which means that you can't be making noise, which means you can't be having your girlfriends over or mates that just make you feel a bit lighter, because what you really need is probably a nap more than anything. So you're constantly juggling some social time for yourself mm. where people don't bring up the illness conversation.
Yeah.
You just need time to be normal with other people, and you do get lonely, definitely. And, you know, times like that, you really need to have something on the boil. And what I mean by that is, because you talked about anxiety levels going up with carers, which is 100% true. You know, it's interesting. During COVID, anxiety has become my number one area of treatment.
Mm. Yeah.
People have been isolated. They have been out of their routines. And anxiety is essentially a fear of the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If anxiety had a thought bubble above its head, it would be, what if?
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Yeah. Whereas depression, if it had a thought bubble, it would say, if only. Mm.
Yeah.
If only that had or hadn't happened, or mm-hmm. she had been ill or not ill or whatever.
Mm.
So one of the things that I really recommend to carers is get a lot of ritual and routine. We're talking structure into mm-hmm. your life, because there's going to be poop that hits the fan all the time and you're going to be flying blind.
Yeah.
But if your brain asks the question, what's going to happen, and you have a good answer for it, it will shut up.
Mm. Yeah.
Like children in the back seat. Mm-hmm. Are we there yet?
Mm-hmm.
No. Are we there yet? No. Are we there yet? Yeah, we're almost there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So ritual and routine will make you less lonely if they involve other people, especially.
The loneliness is a...
And you're a man too, and men do lonely better than anyone. Y'all don't reach out. You're like the strong, silent type being, oh, machismo. I'm fine. I'm a rock. Mm, really? You look like rubble to me.
Yeah, I've been rubble more than once.
Yeah, I bet you have.
It's an interesting, the more you think about it, the worse it gets.
Oh, yes.
Because like, you're lonely because you can't really talk about the stuff because you don't really want to talk about the stuff because the stuff is
sometimes
really, really hard
to
talk about,
yeah,
right?
You need time out from it.
But then people ask, you know, how's your sister?
Yeah.
And then you've sort of thrust into talking about it when necessarily you didn't want to.
Mm. I have a pat answer for that. In recovery.
Yeah.
How are they? In recovery. Great. Okay. It's like the kid. Are we there yet?
Yeah.
How's your sister? In recovery. I answer the question. Now the brain will shut up. Let's get on with something else.
Yeah. It's a weird environment to be in.
That truly, you do become the gatekeeper of information.
Yeah.
And that's another really nice thing about a closed friendship or friend and family group on Facebook. You only have to post once.
Yeah.
And you know,
people understand.
Yeah. And, you know, you put a little rider, you know, in the group. No questions, please.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to tell you how it is and don't come back to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. No. Mama needs a nap.
Yeah. I'm just loving just sitting here watching the two of you have a carers discussion going, yes, really nothing to do with me.
But I do want your take on this though, because I find it fascinating sitting with you here, listening to this stuff.
Yeah.
I just want to know what you think about it because it's a different lens, right? Like
totally. Yeah.
It's easy for me to say, oh, look, don't fucking talk to me about Nicole's kid. Like, when you went actually through it.
Yeah.
And that's worse.
Yeah. But, you know, it's really funny, right? Because I think so much of this comes back to just being human. This mm-hmm. stuff is just a human experience.
It is.
And, you know, when we say, oh, don't ask that question, you know, what can I do to help? Like, again, I've asked that question.
And I know I'll do it again.
Exactly. Yeah. You know you do. Yeah. You know that you just want to, you know, you just want to do something and yeah. you just, yeah. and you don't know how to do it. But I sit here kind of, you know, reflecting on the fact that, you know, we are all at some point in a human way transitioning through a period of need and also want, you know, yeah. And as part of this cancer experience, for me, there's been so many other people who have been impacted. And sometimes you do fall into a habit of just thinking about yourself and the pointy end of my own experience, but it's so much more than that. You know, there's my family and my husband and, you know, our child, even the dog, you know, yeah. everyone's got needs and wants that have evolved as part of my experience. And so just taking time to recognize that and think about that and put structures in place. And yeah. I love the idea of routine and ritual.
Yeah.
That's so great. Healing. Yeah. It's so soothing. You know, it was funny because I was sitting in here with a patient one day and she, you know, she was going through something like this. And I said, wow, you need that ritual. Ritual is beautiful because it intimates something that is healing, something that is beautiful. Routine, not necessarily. Mm. But the word ritual and routine, I was saying, yeah, we're going to have to create some rituals and routines for you so that you can get through this. She goes, so what are yours? And I said, hold on, I'll open my diary yes. and share a week with you. And, you know, we went through, she's like, wow, so you've got exercise like 4 times a week. I go, yeah, it keeps me sane.
Mm. Yeah.
Healthy body, healthy mind. Yeah. Mm. Lots of endorphins as well. Mm. And then she said, oh, look, on Tuesday, other than work, there's nothing there. And I'm like, oh, well noted. Mm. I go, wow, what would I do on Tuesday? She goes, well, what do you love? I go, I love laying in the bath. She goes, maybe you could have special bath Tuesday. I'm like, oh, let's put that in now. Put it on perpetual, weekly, repeat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And she said, what will be special about it? I go, oh, just because we say it is.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then you go, oh, what could I do to make it special? Ooh, candle, glass of wine, nice aromas, nobody else in the bathroom.
Yeah.
So anything can become a ritual. In fact, a good friend of mine really put me on to the small things and how they become so meaningful if they happen ritualistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, you know, you should write a book called Ritual Joys.
Mm.
And of course she isn't, but maybe I'll write one. I don't know. I find writing easy and therapeutic. Maybe that's the next one.
I collect records.
Do you now?
Because, and Tim, Nicole's husband, laughs at me constantly about it because he's like, oh, my favorite thing about records is the inconvenience. But I like the...
Oh, I know why you like it.
It's intentional, right?
Yeah.
If you're putting on a record, you're doing it to sit and listen to music. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes your time.
Yeah.
Rather than jumping on whatever streaming app you happen to favor and playing some music that just becomes background noise.
Yeah.
It's an intentional... sort of mindful experience, and I love it for that.
It is.
Mm. And I think that, you know, the intention, as you said, with the bath, anything can be special if you're doing it because it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it is what you say it is.
Yeah.
Mm. Can I ask a question? I feel like...
You may.
This is such a useful conversation in terms of carers themselves and how they can think. And we've also spoken about, you know, how we can help people who are surrounding carers mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, how they can provide better support. But I'm interested in your take, Perry, and maybe yours too, Sean. We've got lots of people who listen to our podcast who are system participants, who are doctors, who are nurses, who are bureaucrats, who are the people setting policy. What can those people do for carers? What does the system need to do for carers?
I think the best thing that anyone in a system could do would be to take the time to find out what it's like for that person who is caring because they're just in the TikTok do it mode.
Yep.
Maybe they haven't been in that position before.
Yeah.
You know, one of the best oncologists I know had cancer himself. Mm. He's like, oh, this was a game changer.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think that as well. And I think for organizations to work together. So, you know, you've got Care Australia, It would be good for them to have forums like this, but with more people, so the conversation, it stays open.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize a carer as a participant in the process.
Totally.
And if you just start there, I think only good things can come, right?
But yeah, to give you some eye contact and find out what's really going on with you, because without the carer, she's going to get real.
Yeah, the wheels fall off quick, right? Yeah,
totally. And I think when we're having this conversation all the time about patient-centered care
within
the system, that actually necessitates a conversation around
carer-centered care.
Completely.
And that's because, a great term. It should be, we should have stuff about carer-centered care.
Yeah, we need to, because we can't actually allow the patient to be centered in their care unless they have the requisite support and their support network, their formal, articulated, intentional support network needs to be recognized.
Yeah.
And it's such an important thing, and I need to kind of drive that home again and again, is that, you know, my capacity as a patient to do what I need to do to continue to show up, you know, that's so driven by my network of support. And, you know, and nurses and doctors will be the first people to say, like, we can't keep providing that, you know, like, I've been in hospital and needed support because I'm a falls risk, right? Yeah. So I need support to go for a walk.
Yeah, and so they'll just keep you in bed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they'll say, you know, like, really, really sorry, love, but I don't have the time to be in here every 2 hours to help you walk around because exercise is good for you during chemo while you're a falls risk. It's like, well, that's great. Meanwhile, you know, if
I'm atrophying.
If I'm going to actually make it through this treatment, I need that support. So there needs to be that middle ground. You know, we need to find a place to make
absolutely
that work.
Yeah. And, you know, we need a network. I think we need a network where people who have care experience, who have the will, can actually sign up and be proxy for you.
Yes.
You know, like I said, I married into a huge family, so we had plenty of proxy. But there are plenty of people sitting in chemo who don't have that support.
Yeah.
And even when they're not in chemo anymore and they have other needs, people go, oh, you're in remission. Great. Poop, we don't talk to you anymore.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, well, phew. Okay, we got through that.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. I can't feel my hands and feet. And, you know, wow, I don't sleep and I'm sweating because I've had chemo for so long. You still need a support team. And it really, they say it takes a village to raise a child.
Mm.
I say it takes a village to make it through.
Yeah. But this is true at every level of the patient experience, right? Like, I know a guy who's just an ACL reconstruction, and I've had a couple of them, and that's not a fun time. But you have, in that experience as a patient, a really defined finish line, a really defined treatment plan. Like, that's know what the process is, but it's still really difficult.
Yeah.
And you still need people around you who get it. And can get you through it.
Support that,
And even then, the toll would be difficult on someone who has to, like, help you go to the toilet every time you got to go because you can't walk, right? Like,
pull your underwear on
for you. Exactly, or, showering, like, all that stuff.
Or wound care, tough. You need an injection.
Yeah.
Or,
But I think that's, I think you've touched on a really important point there, that that's a really tough job for a carer, right? But you do that job not just because you have to, but because where else are you going to be?
Yeah.
There is nowhere else on the planet you would be, right? But you still need help.
Yeah, just because you want to doesn't mean that you don't need assistance too.
Yeah.
Mm. And, you know, absolutely, where else would you be?
Can we talk about Perry's book?
You may.
Mm.
You know what I do want to talk about before we talk about that? I want to talk about the emotional roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to just say that whatever you're feeling is okay. I remember somebody saying to me, Perry, it's okay. I go, don't tell me it's okay. It's not okay. She goes, no, what I mean is it's all okay. Whatever you're feeling is okay. If you're feeling mad, if you're feeling sad, if you're feeling bad, if you're feeling glad, it's okay to feel okay.
Yeah, just to normalize all of that.
Yeah. You know, they have the whole Beyond Blue, it's okay not to be okay.
Mm.
Well, sometimes when the person that you love the most, you know, is really sick, in my case, dying, you may have a day when, you know, like, I remember driving down the coast and I drive a convertible, so it gives you a lot of air and a lot of sky. And this Rosella flew above my windscreen line. And just as it was flying across, it turned and it made eye contact with me. And I'll never forget it. It was so beautiful. And I thought, oh my God, that was so, I don't know, it was so uplifting.
Mm.
And I thought, am I allowed to feel uplifted?
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't know. Had to pull over.
Yeah.
So it is okay to feel okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that intensity of actually as a human experience, am I allowed to be happy during a period of profound sadness?
Yeah.
You know, is that even permitted?
Mm.
Yeah. Does it make you a bad person?
Exactly. Yeah.
No.
Just to experience human emotion, you know, just to go through the stuff that people go through.
Because you're going to have good days.
Thank you, Perry, for sharing that with us.
You should love it.
Yeah.
You know, I think in incredibly sad times, you should laugh as much as you can.
Yeah.
For one thing, it's going to change your biochemistry radically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a blood test before and after a good laugh looks like a totally different person.
Mm. Yeah.
They're like full of endorphins and they cover pain, and you're full of dopamine, which is a natural high, and serotonin, which is your happy hormone, which is essentially what's in antidepressants.
Mm.
And then you get full of oxytocin, which is your love drug. It makes you feel loved and secure. Mm. And people, I'm telling you, people will judge you if you're having a big laugh in chemo. Yeah,
totally.
Or they'll judge you, you know, if you've just had a bad diagnosis and you find something to laugh about. They will give you the look.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm like, you know something? I need to have a laugh right now more than you.
Mm. Yeah.
And I really want carers to get it that, you know, God, go and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're a patient, God, go and enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. So anyway, what were you asking about?
Book.
Oh, book. Book. Mm. You know, I just, like you, Sean, I found there were so few resources for carers. It's a short guide for getting through as a carer and making sure you come out the other end as a fully functioning human being. There's not a person on the planet who's not going to be either a carer, cared for, or both in their life. So if you can get across what it takes to get through as a carer, get across it early.
Yeah.
It's 100% relative to 100% of the population.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what made me write.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it for kicks.
Yeah.
I did it for service. And, you know, that's all I really want for people, is not to have to do it tough or fly blind or reinvent a wheel. Mm. I just want to keep them rolling until they don't need to roll anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, I don't want to summarize this chat because it's not my role, because this is your chat.
Yeah, but you're so good at it.
I do want to insert something at this point.
Go on.
I actually feel quite proud of this conversation. Mm. I feel like, you know, we wanted to give a voice to the patient experience, but the patient, in my case, from my experience, could not function without the carer, without that support network. And I just feel like, you know, spending an episode talking about this and giving it, you know, the place in the picture, in the system that it deserves, you know, the carer as an identity, the carer as an experience, and the carer's own care requirements is just such an essential conversation. And I'm so grateful to both of you for, you know, for bringing your own perspective on that, but your own very personal emotional experience as well. So thank you both for doing that.
I have loved this because I think it's so needed and it's so overlooked.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's underrated, overlooked, but so necessary.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been interesting talking with you, Sean, because you and I have a very similar experience, and like our eye contact has been like so deep.
Yep.
And then I'm like, oh yeah.
Nicole's here as well.
Yeah. Nicole's over there. And there's Pat the dog, my therapy dog at my feet. I'm like, oh, hi, Pat. Yeah. How are you going? But yeah, there were moments when it was just you and a bit of soft haze and so beautiful. Mm. Thank you.
No, I want to thank you, Perry. Your contribution, I don't actually have words to express the appreciation properly.
We'll hug. That will do it.
That'll do it. Thank you so much for being involved and for sharing, you know, your own personal stuff and your professional stuff that will be of great help to people who need it.
It's, you know, people say it's an honor and a privilege, but I really mean it. It's an honor and a privilege.
Okay, so today I actually got to sit back and just be an observer, really, for a lot of the conversation that happened between you and Perry.
I'm already, like, you already know the joke that's coming.
Yep. Go on then.
It's rare.
It's rare. It's rare. But it happens. And it did today.
But it does happen.
But it does happen. But it is rare. But it does happen. Obviously, I want to thank Perry and for her participation and her insights professionally. But something that struck me, of course, as I'm sitting there, is this person with so much knowledge and so much expertise and professional capacity in terms of mental health and the insights she's offering to us, so much of that is actually born from her lived experience as a carer.
Yeah.
Right? And how much we all actually kind of straddle life and life in general and what we're good at and identity and, you know, what we strive for and what we've gone to uni to study or what we've learned through school or what we've built a life around, you know, at home with our families or whatever it is that is our day job, you know. And then we have becoming a carer or becoming a patient or having to deal with a crisis and everything that that brings out, you know. And here is a perfect example of someone who has got all of those threads of her life coming together in a lived way that of course has of course impacted her so significantly, you know, and we can't the fact that someone has to go through such trauma to have such insight, of course there's a tragedy attached to that, right? But equally someone who goes through that trauma and chooses to pivot that and change that into something meaningful for others,
yeah,
to allow other people to benefit from that lived experience. That's the stuff that makes being a human so special, right? And just seeing the two of you share that lived experience of what it is to care so deeply for someone else, and not necessarily be in control of that, not necessarily be the most important person in the room, you know, during those discussions according to the system, but be a person who is prepared to just restructure their entire life for the good of others, you know. I think that's what caring is, you know. That's what it's all about. Mm. And, yeah, I was very moved watching the two of you talk and of course, hearing Perry's story and her insights and everything that she shared with us today.
It's a profoundly life-altering experience.
Yeah.
Being a carer, I guess. But the thing that I want to make as clear as I can,
mm-hmm,
not known for being an articulate person.
Yes, you are.
Is this. This is my thing. If you know someone that is a patient, you are either, you know, involved in their care or you are not. Yeah. And if you are not, and you would like to be,
mm,
there's so much you can do that, yeah, we've sort of discussed.
Yeah.
If you are not, and you're not in the place where you can,
yeah,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's important to acknowledge at the top of this or at the tail of this or whatever this bit of this is that this is not like a finger pointy blamey exercise. Yeah. This is a, if you want to help but you don't know how to help, like yeah, so many people.
Yeah.
I know I've been through that myself.
Yeah.
Then there are strategies. Mm. There are specific things that you can do that would absolutely make all the difference in the world.
Yeah. But if you're the person who just can't cope,
then please.
Then that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
And I am that
person at the moment, right?
Yeah, like, so am I. Yeah. I so relate to that. Like I see people going through tragedy, trauma, crisis all around me and, you know, and I've got friends who through this process of the last 5 years when I've been sick, I would have loved to have provided some kind of support and care to them.
Yeah.
But I just can't.
Don't have it in you.
I just don't have it in me and that's actually okay too.
Yeah.
It's really okay.
Mm. Did you know the thing I always struggle with most? So I press that little red button that starts the song and yeah, that like means we're wrapping it up. But I'm yeah, always like, but who's going to say end with that?
You.
Well, sometimes you do.
But you just did.
Oh.
And with that. Oh, I broke my pen.
It's all happening here at the Impatient Podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Look out.
No, I do have a genuine, legitimate, serious question for you though.
Okay.
How'd yep, you feel that today it wasn't about you?
I feel good.
Really?
I feel good. Yeah, I feel good.
I'm surprised by that.
Look, we're all patients at the end of the day. I'm pretty sure we open up with a segment that talks about both of our patient lives. Just saying. Just because it wasn't overtly my cancer. I think I have said this point a few times that I just love learning new things.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot about being a carer. I really have.
Yeah.
My husband would say I need to learn those lessons. Because when he gets a cold, apparently I'm useless, so...
Just want some chicken noodle soup.
Exactly. And I've got nothing. I'm just like, yeah, but come on, just get out of bed. I mean, seriously.
You'll be fine.
Come on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, any other sort of shout outs? Probably thank our guests.
Yeah, no, good guest this week.
Really solid guest. Yeah. Jess was amazing. Perry was amazing. People giving so much of their personal stories. The vulnerability that comes to the Inpatient Podcast is just amazing.
Yeah. Shout out to whoever is next.
Yeah, shout out to whoever's next, whoever's sitting at home going,
listening right now.
I need to talk to these guys. And even if you're listening going, well, I've kind of emailed them a couple of times and messaged Nicole on Instagram. She's never responded. Do that again.
Do that. Please know that there's two people that spring to mind instantly where I'm like, oh, man, we need to
email that's right. I need to email that person back. Yeah. But no, we really do want to speak to anyone and everyone who wants to speak to us. And I do apologize if I haven't responded. And that's, I wasn't just going to go ahead and blame being a cancer patient.
Yeah, but I'm going to call you out on that right now because you literally just told us probably about an hour ago in the scheme of the episode, but that you've got so much time on your hands, you've got nothing to do, and here you are not emailing people back. You've got no excuse.
I'm sorry. I'm going to get on that now.
Okay.
I'm emailing right now. Good. Failing that, please email us.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll chat soon. Much love.
Okay, bye.
Bye.